Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. The Roma are coming. The Roma are coming. Next year, our borders open to Romanian and Bulgarian workers, and politicians on both left and right are calling it a huge mistake, but have legitimate concerns about jobs spilled over into outright racism against the Roma. Also, living on a synthetic high, can you be a genuine party animal on fake beer and fake cigarettes? I'm joined in the studio by The Telegraph's chief political commentator Peter Oborne, by the leader of UKIP Nigel Farage, and by Damien Thompson, the editor of Telegraph Blogs. Next January, Romania and Bulgaria will be given unfettered access to the UK's labour market. These countries are poor, very poor, and there's a widespread fear that tens of thousands of immigrants could come to Britain in search of better paid jobs and generous welfare support. Migration Watch says the figure could be as high as 250,000. Of particular concern, maybe a little too much concern, is the potential arrival of a large population of Roma. This week, David Blunkett, the former Labour Home Secretary, warned that the Roma's arrival could even spark a riot. In language redolent of the rivers of blood, he said that they need to alter their, quote, behaviour and stop, quote, aggravating people. He went on to say, "We've got to be tough and robust in saying to people you are not in a downtrodden village or woodland, because many of them don't even live in areas where there are toilets or refuse collection facilities. You are not there anymore, you are here, and you've got to adhere to our standards." Nigel Farage, you've congratulated David Blunkett and said that he should be admired for being so honest about the specific problem of integrating the Roma. But the European Roma Rights Commission says that this kind of language is, quote, dangerous and really belongs only on the far right. If you predict riots, doesn't that become a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy?
Not necessarily, no. But I mean, the point I was making was, this was the guy who was the Home Secretary at the time we opened the doors to Poland, Latvia, Lithuania back in 2004, admitting that he's made the biggest political mistake of his career. That is a very significant piece of news from somebody who is a respected political figure in this country and who nobody would in their wildest of dreams think is a far-right figure. I mean, to me, the problem isn't just one of integration. The problem is, why are we allowing these people to come into this country at all?
Yeah.
I mean, that really is the point.
But what we've been talking about the last couple of days, I mean, you're absolutely right. He's admitted it was wrong. Jack Straw's admitted it was wrong.
Yeah.
But we're now talking about the future and very specific groups. And if you say that there might be a riot, do you not stoke fears that themselves lead to a riot?
Well, I haven't suggested that for a moment. David Blunkett has. So it's not, you know, ask him that question, not me. But I would say this to you. Very few commentators in this country who talk about the Roma have any idea what they're talking about. I have visited the biggest Roma camp in Sofia. I was there 6 months ago. I've also been to several of the more rural Roma communities in Romania. And, you know, there's a group of people here who are totally excluded from society. They don't have jobs. They don't have a decent place to live. They are loathed and despised by many of their fellow countrymen. And in many cases, they have had to turn to crime as a means of survival. Now, if you just look at what's happened in Paris, and I'm not scapegoating anybody, I'm being factual here.
Mm-hmm.
If you just look at the streets of Paris, you know, get off the Eurostar at Gare du Nord and go for a short walk through Paris, you will be accosted by Roma beggars probably at the rate of one every minute. And if you look at the crime figures in Paris and you realise that we're saying on the 1st of January next year, the door is open, you know, you're all welcome to come here. And I just think this is a wholly irresponsible thing to do. But I'd also say this. It's very interesting that Straw and Blunkett have made their comments. But I've been talking to Tory MPs and MEPs and Labour MPs and MEPs, and they all greatly underestimate potentially how big this is in British politics. I honestly think that if very large numbers come from Romania and Bulgaria, including the Roma, if very large numbers come next year, I think it's got the potential to change British politics in a way that people can't believe.
Peter, can you comment on the Roma issue?
Yeah, I think, though, that let's remember that the vast majority of people are going to come from Bulgaria and Romania are going to be sort of migrant workers looking for a job, as a whole hard-working and honest people. And Nigel Farage was right to say we don't know about the Roma. My guess is the great majority of Roma are hardworking and honest people as well. And I do think there is a real problem in the language of David Blunkett, which is that you are The Roma is a wandering folk. There was an attempt made by Hitler to exterminate them. I think he got rid of, I think 500,000 I read. And the singling out of an ethnic minority is a very troubling thing. We know that from history. And so I do think that we have to be very careful with our language. That said, I think I understand what Mr. Farage is saying is that suddenly on the 1st of January, there's going to be our borders are going to be opened. It's a very significant decision by which has nothing to do with British politicians. I mean, there's no consent to this. And so people don't understand why it's happening.
I'm sorry, Peter, I don't agree with that at all. Mm-hmm. This is a decision of British politicians. It's just that the decision wasn't taken in Westminster.
Okay. I do want to come
on
to that point.
Hang on. This decision was endorsed by the European Parliament with the full support of Labour, Lib Dem and Conservative MEPs. Let's just remember that.
Okay. I do want to address that issue, but I want to wrap up the point about the Roma, because what I think Peter's just said is very important and very powerful. I mean, you've described them as being a marginalised people. But by using this language about them...
I haven't used this language. David Blunkett has used this language. Right. What I have said is this. I have visited their communities. They are singled out. They are treated about as well as the Jews were in the mid-1930s in Germany. Let's be frank. These are the circumstances these people are living in Romania and Bulgaria. And if you don't believe me, go and see it. It's unbelievable. But...
Isn't that a very good case, then, for taking them?
How many? 500,000? 1,000,000? 2,000,000? 3,000,000? I mean, what do you suggest?
Well, a very similar debate was had about the Jews in the 1930s.
Well, but they're not... Yeah, they are excluded from society. I don't think, because they're excluded from society, they count as refugees. They're not actually going to be... They're not actually being killed. They're just being treated very badly in their own communities. And mm-hmm. whilst I feel sorry for them, because I've been there and met them, I think the message that has to come from this country is we've got enough social problems of our own without taking on any more.
Peter?
I think that if we were to do something as massive as take on board the Roma problem ourselves, for which there is a strong ethical argument, there would have to be, first of all, a democratic argument made by politicians, say, look, we're going to do this for these reasons, because we're that sort of country, we celebrate toleration. I just think suddenly, without any debate about it at all, mm-hmm. Suddenly to have an unknown number of Roma on our streets is dangerous. And one of the problems about this decision, what's going to happen on the 1st of January, is that it's basically nobody's talked about it, nobody's defended it, nobody's made the case for it, and it's very difficult to make the case against it because how do you stop it happening now? Because if it's it works through EU law. And this is, although I deprecate, I think that Mr. Blunkett was wrong to say what he did. That he is articulating, I am quite certain, views felt strongly by his constituents.
But we could do something, couldn't we? It's not very difficult. All Mr. Cameron has to do is to go to the next European summit and say, I'm sorry, but when we signed these treaties 40 years ago, we had no understanding or idea that this is what it would lead to. And in this particular case, we are not prepared to open the doors fully to Romania and Bulgaria. That's all he has to do. All it takes is political will. Yes, I know he'd be in breach of treaty. And perhaps the good thing about doing that is we could then put it to a referendum and settle the whole question of open borders before the next general election.
Put simply, the issue of open borders to referendum.
Well, I think when we have a referendum on EU membership, provided UKIP stays strong, will happen, mm-hmm. I think open borders will become the dominant part of that debate.
Okay. I am sensing a shift then in the UKIP strategy and focus, talking less about money going to the EU, talking more about its sort of impact upon this country. Is that what's sort of going on here?
I mean, well, I think 20 years ago, you know, the Eurosceptic debate, which was led by Bill Cash and others in the Commons and UKIP and Jimmy Goldsmith, in those days, we talked about the European question in constitutional terms, in historical terms. But now we don't need to do that, because now we talk about the impact upon people's daily lives. You know, and I've just come back from Boston in Lincolnshire, where the population of that town has gone from 50 to 70,000 in the course of the last 10 years. People in Boston aren't really very worried about Article 136, subsection 2 of the European Treaty, but they are worried about what's happened to their community.
Peter, do you agree with that? Do you think that there is now a growing realisation among ordinary people of the impact of the EU upon their personal lives?
I think the example of Boston is an extremely good one. And the EU is not a democratic organisation.
Mm-hmm.
It's whether or not you call it anti-democratic, I don't know, but you certainly call it non-democratic. Mm. It's part of a... it's controlled by elites, by technocrats, and not by national politicians. And so this is a classic example of a decision made by Europe, which the people of France... Greece, etc., had no choice in is the euro. They're now run by foreign bankers. Greece is, thanks to the European Union. That is so dangerous, and that's why you get the rise of a far right party. Likewise, effectively, the Spanish are run by foreign bankers. The euro was a demented technocratic idea imposed with nobody wanting it, apart from the guys who run the European Union. Free movement of peoples is a wonderful idea, but once again, there's been no consent. Nobody asked for it. It wasn't made in Britain. It's a non-democratic decision. It sucked the legitimacy outside our political system. We must, on such an issue as important as borders or how we manage our own economic affairs, surely that those are decisions which must be made by democratic politicians and accountable to the people for whom they're responsible.
And yet our leaders want it. I mean, Mr Cameron, and supported, of course, by Clegg and Miliband, but Mr Cameron is the biggest advocate for opening up the borders unconditionally to Turkey as well. So, I mean, there's no stopping these people. It's perfectly clear the British political class support total free movement of peoals with poor countries in Eastern and Southern
and
Europe.
And why is there such a lack of will to resist it?
Because they believe in it.
Right.
They're not going to resist it because they actually believe in it. And I suppose, in a way, if you came from the same background as our current political leaders, open-door immigration is a very good thing. Cheaper nannies, cheaper gardeners, cheaper chauffeurs. And it's part of the complete disconnect between the Westminster political class and ordinary real folk trying to live their lives out there, because what they see is a million young people between 16 and 24, unemployed, and they're not all scum and lazy and useless. And I get really angry when I hear all our politicians, including Boris, say how dreadful Britain's youth is. No, lots of them want work and now find themselves discriminated against in their own country. And you then move on to the level of skilled people. You know, people working on building sites, perhaps as bricklayers, plumbers, carpenters. And what's happened to them, of course, is that their income has been driven down to the floor over the course of the last few years.
I don't agree. I think you're being unfair, and I don't think you have any evidence for your claim that our three-party leaders support the free movement.
Of course they do. Mr Cameron is enthused about it. Why on earth would he want Turkey to join?
Well, there's a great argument, actually.
And why did he three-line whip his own people to vote for the opening of the doors to Romania and Bulgaria?
Peter.
The facts are
there. I don't think for one moment that Cameron... He hasn't got any choice. The
point of course he has.
He hasn't. This is something which was signed up to 8 years ago. And that is what the only way Cameron can stop it happening is by declaring war on the European Union, risking Britain leaving the European Union. It's quite easy for you, because you're not in power, you're in opposition, to say so. Cameron has got a way, different...
And Peter, I voted against it, but the Conservative Party voted for it, and that's the point.
Yes. You voted against it in 1975.
When the issue of opening the doors to Eastern Europe January 2004, I voted against. And a year later, we had the accession of Romania and Bulgaria. And would you believe, it was actually a Conservative MEP, Geoffrey Van Orden, who was what's called the rapporteur, i.e. the sponsor, for Bulgaria to join the European Union. Don't tell me Mr Cameron doesn't want this. He is fully behind it.
Yeah, but I think Peter's point is that what he really wants is to try and stay within a reformed European Union. And
My point is, Mr Cameron has openly supported total free movement of peoples between this country and Romania and Bulgaria, and the evidence is all there.
Peter, you mentioned the rise of far-right parties being one consequence. Do you put UKIP in that bracket?
Definitely not. No. I mean, if UKIP I celebrate the rise of UKIP in Britain. If they were racist, I would immediately run 100 miles. I believe they articulate something other political parties can't. If there was any aspect... Marie Le Pen's party, there's allegations of anti-Semitism. If UKIP was anti-Semitic, we wouldn't go near it. It seems to treat some of it, you know, it's very difficult because it does defy political correctness, and therefore some of its members and some of its representatives even may say daft things. I think Mr. Farage has a difficult course to plant. Sorry, that's not a very good expression. A difficult journey to make. But I think as a whole, he's handled himself reasonably well so far. I don't think they're far right. I think that they articulate something which no other British political party is able to do.
But they are attracting far-right interest, because apparently Marine Le Pen and Geert Wilders have asked if you consider joining an alliance. Would you do that? Of course.
They desperately... They want to form a new group in the European Parliament, and they desperately need members. And they anticipate that UKIP will come back to the European Parliament next year with a lot of MEPs. The answer to that's terribly simple. I do have some personal regard for Marine Le Pen. I think she's a remarkable woman. I think she has taken the Front National and tried her best to change it. In fact, the first exclusive interview she gave was to the Daily Telegraph when she became leader, when she said, I want this party to become a reflection of UKIP and not the BNP. All right, so I do admire her for trying to do that. However, the baggage that exists within the Front National is so deeply anti-Semitic that I almost feel it's part of the DNA of that party. And for that reason, we in UKIP will not be doing a deal with them now or at any point in the future.
Why is Marine Le Pen a remarkable woman? Is this just a case of flattery getting you everywhere? She likes you.
So. No. She's a remarkable woman because she has shown tremendous courage in trying to take on the extremists in her own party, including her father. You know, there have been several public spats between her and the old man. And so I think she has got some courage. You know, and I think what she's done in terms of their opinion poll rating and everything else is extraordinary. You know, whether you like someone's politics or not, it doesn't mean you shouldn't respect their ability. And this woman has a very considerable ability.
Thank you both very much. We all love a drink or two or three or four, and we all know the cost. In the short term, nausea and paranoia about a series of phone calls you made to your boss at 3 a.m. In the long term, maybe addiction and even disease. But they may all be history now, thanks to the invention of a new alcoholic substitute. It's poured into a flavoured non-alcoholic cocktail and, when knocked back, creates all the giddy sensation of being intoxicated. But when you want it to end, all you have to do is take an antidote. And within a little while, you're back on your feet and feeling perfectly sober. No hangover is needed. So what would life be like if it was lived through substitutes? Just to give some background, we have some non-alcoholic beer floating around. Not that I'm not saying who is drinking it, but and also some people are trying some e-cigarettes. But I want to start with Damien and ask, as a former drinker, would you be tempted to try this alcohol substitute?
Oh, I wouldn't just be tempted. I would try it.
You would?
Because I'm so curious.
Right.
That said... would it make me feel uneasy? It's only 20 years since I had my last alcoholic drink, and I'm certainly not planning to have another one. I think it's not just the thought of drinking an alcohol substitute that would make me feel uneasy, though I'd still do it because I'm so curious about it. But it raises really quite an interesting question, which is, here we have a way of enhancing your mood with no punishment, as it were. And I think we're moving in that direction generally. We're finding more and more ways to make the brain, you know, produce pleasure-inducing chemicals.
Isn't that a bad thing? Because if you can be happy all the time, of course you'll choose to be happy all the
time. Well, I don't know if it's a bad thing or not, though I suspect it might be, but it's a very interesting thing, because what we're talking about is, it's a bit like Aldous Huxley's Soma. What we're talking about is altering, if you like, the sort of base level of human happiness so that you can actually take something that keeps you happy, at least judged by our present standards, all the time, and are you perhaps unable to face the prospect of being unhappy or not equipped to anymore?
Nigel, would you be tempted to try it?
No.
Why not?
Not at all.
No. Why not?
Well, I enjoy a drink, as is quite well known. I like a pint of beer and a glass of wine, and I want to have a hangover the next day. I want to feel rotten the next day, because that's my self-adjustment mechanism, because next time round that tells me I'm going to stay within sensible limits, because I'm up at 5 o'clock tomorrow morning. So, no, for me, I'm perfectly happy where I am with alcohol. I accept that there are some people who have a huge problem with it. My worry about alcohol is slightly different. My worry is there is a culture now amongst our young people, even our bright young people, that says they don't go out for a drink to have fun. They actually go out with the intention of getting hammered.
Yeah.
And I've never done that in my life. It has happened as a byproduct, but I've never done it. I've never gone out with that intention. And, yeah. and so we have got a problem with our youth. Maybe if it helped with them, that'd be a good thing. But for me, no interest.
Peter, if I could take a pill and there was no consequence to getting hungover, I'd be drunk all the time, wouldn't you? I would just be always drinking, knowing there'd be no pain at the end of it.
I think the thing about this this new invention is that we drink. I agree entirely with Nigel Farage. We drink because we enjoy. I mean, you drink because of a pleasure of a real nice pint. I mean, you know, London Pride or something. Or you know, a bottle of really nice French claret or Burgundy.
Yeah.
And that's why you're drinking, or a Scotch. You know, really nice Scotch. You don't take a pill to make you. You don't drink in order to get drunk, is what I'm really saying.
Mm. Oh, I do.
Or even to feel drunk.
When I was a student, we did. And it's not just me. I mean, all of us went out to get hammered. And actually, in my days in AA, which are a long time ago, but I remember one of the sayings they came out with was, what's the difference between an ordinary drinker and an alcoholic? An ordinary drinker says, I'm going to go out to the pub and get really hammered. And an alcoholic says, I'm going to go out to the pub and not get hammered.
Well, can you explain that? So you're saying
the alcoholic is worried about losing control, whereas the normal drinker knows perfectly well that he or she can get hammered and will have a hangover, and that's the end of it.
Yeah.
But for the alcoholic, they don't necessarily know where it's going to end up. It could go on for 3 or 4 days.
Right, right. Ooh. I also think hangover is part of the human experience.
Punishment for any pleasurable experience is part of the human experience. So, you know, if you eat too much, you get fat. Mm. But are we reaching a stage where we're going to be able to experience pleasure without any cost?
Right.
And that's interesting.
Right.
Because will then people choose to live their entire lives in a state of elevated consciousness?
To some extent, we're doing that already, aren't we? I mean, we're drugging half the population. Well, not quite half, but we've got 3 million people in this country on Prozac, on prescription.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, we're almost doing it anyway.
Yeah.
Is that a good thing? I rather doubt it, actually.
And we're also giving children Ritalin, which is a very strong, and I've taken this, actually. It's quite a fun drug, but you think they're giving it to 9-year-olds.
I know. No, I think we're drugging people far too much already, thank you.
Do you think that the e-cigarette is a good substitute? Both Nigel and Peter have been puffing away on an e-cigarette.
I feel this is an issue that I feel very, very strongly about. There is no question in my mind that the e-cigarette is the first genuine smoking substitute that has come along that actually works. And I've got two mates of mine who I know well. One, a guy who's been at sea 50 years, and he's a 60-a-day smoker. And I went to see him in Cornwall this summer. Completely stopped smoking, hasn't had a cigarette since May, doesn't even feel like having a cigarette, and he chews on e-cigarettes all day long, but absolute proof to me that it works. And what is happening, of course not in this country doesn't govern anything, but what's happening in Brussels is we have the giant pharmaceutical lobby who make hundreds of millions of euros every year selling stop-smoking drugs that don't work, and they want to go on selling those drugs, and they are trying to get e-cigarettes labelled as medicines to have all the taste removed from them.
Right.
And this is something I'm a smoker, but I'm never going to make the argument that smoking is good for you. I make the argument the pub should have a separate smoking room.
Oh, here.
But if we really want people who are heavy smokers to cut down, the e-cigarette's the answer.
Yeah.
And it's yet another case where if Brussels does legislate on this, we need to tell them to go to hell.
I agree entirely with you, except that I think that it should be a case of the entire pub is smoking and there's a separate room for
non-smokers.
Peter, have you enjoyed your e-cigarette?
I still don't think it's as good as a real cigarette.
It's pretty close, though, isn't it?
But it doesn't come to a natural finish. That's the thing. A cigarette is like a journey. Mm-hmm. It's like a story of its own. And it has a beginning, a middle,
what
and end.
What have you been smoking?
I don't know.
A eulogy to tobacco.
What I found in your drawer earlier, Damien. Damien Thompson, Nigel Farage, and Peter Oborne, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
For more opinion and commentary, you can find us at telegraph.co.uk.